Some of you have seen this stock in crypto, so those of you who have seen it, like Monia, saying it's a slightly expanded version of the stock, and I spent way too much time on airplanes, on multiple airplanes jazzing it up. So the official title of the paper is Private Key Research on Streaming Data, and I think the main point that I want to make today is that there is some interesting problem there that I don't know how to solve. So this is just that kind of slides. So let's say each hour we wish to find if any of hundreds of passenger list has name of possible terrorist, and if so, his or her itinerary. And possible terrorist list is typically classified, so should not be revealed to the airports. So tantalizing questions: can the airports help and do all the search work if they are not allowed to get possible terrorist lists? So somehow they want to do the work and go through all their search lists, and not and then tell the, you know, the security services if there is some terrorist name on the list, and if so, what is his itinerary, without the airports knowing what is this possible terrorist list. And so you can imagine, and this is similar to peer, but it's different from peer, that you have some mobile code with state, you send it to airport one, it processes it, sends it to airport two, and so on. And the problem is it possible to design such a software that can be transmitted from airport to airport, including potentially revealing the software to the bad guys, to the adversary, so that software collects all the information that you need without revealing what's collected at each node. And so non-triviality is that must send back only the needed information, not everything. And another motivation is kind of also by the intelligence community. So you're looking for malicious insiders or terrorist communication, like needle in a haystack, right? So first, this is actually what people in the intelligence community actually do. They have some sort of a signature behavior which detects according, you know, which is a suspicious activity. It's complicated rules, and those rules are classified. And then second, they want to detect which node stations or computers have this hidden behavior. And here we want to tackle only part two. And so, is it possible to design software that can capture all messages and network locations that include secret classified set of rules? And key challenge is the software must not reveal what those rules are. Okay, and non-triviality, again, you don't want to send all the messages that are transmitted in the network. You only want to transmit messages that exhibit this hidden behavior. So what we wanted, a very grand challenge, and of course what I'll show you how to do, is a very limited version of it, is you start with some program. This is written by the analyst in the classified setting, which says you are given a stream of data, and you have some decision where most of the data goes into garbage can, and only a small amount of data that is satisfies this classified rules is kept for further analysis by the intelligence communities. But this is all happens in a classified setting. So what you want to do is you want to create a compiler or outputs a straight line executable code, and you'll see in a second why straight line executable is important, with program state and a decryption key D, such that you distribute this code with the state throughout the network, and when different data comes in, you basically, for each piece of data, for each packet, for each email message, you execute this piece of data that updates small state. And then later on, the small state, so that you can think of it as a huge streams of data that are being processed here. And then later on, you can, with the decryption key, get only packets or messages that satisfy the secret rules. And the point here is that someone who runs this straight line executable code with updating the state does not know what are the secret rules. So that's the second problem. And why is it important to have a straight line executable code? Well, look, here the main point is you have a decision. You decide whether any packet or document satisfies this rule or not. If it doesn't satisfy it, you throw it into the garbage. And if it does satisfy it, you keep it. And the point is that you want to hide this particular rule. So you want to hide the decision which documents go here, which documents go here. So if you have any ifs and else in your code, then using a software debugger, a good programmer can always reverse engineer and figure out what goes where. So the kind of interesting question is it possible to write just straight line code that does the same thing for all documents even though somehow inside of it there is even else code inside, but this code is straight line code, even though it implements even else. And the question is it possible or is this just you know, science fiction? And so punchline, we can send executable code without publicly, without revealing what it is that it's searching for. Okay, so the way it's done now in the intelligence community, and that's really how, I mean, okay, is you continuously transfer data to a secure classified environment, and after data is transferred, filter in the classified environment, so then it doesn't reveal any, you know, what the secret rules are, because you take in everything and you drop something to the ground and you keep some stuff, but it's in the classified environment, so no one knows what are the secret rules. So here's animation of this thing. Right, so those are data streams that go in, and in the classified environment, you decide what goes where. Right, so I think I went overboard with the animation. filter rules are written by analysts and are classified. So the point is that this entire green box is in a classified setting, sitting on some well-protected computer. And now, so amount of data that might be transferred to a classified environment is enormous, right? If you want to monitor all packets in the network, you have to send all the packets to the network, so that's pretty expensive. So the drawbacks is communication. You have to take everything into the classified setting. It's processing. Once you transfer it, you have to decide what to keep and what to throw away. And there's cost and timeliness issue, right? You have to transfer everything before you decide what to keep and what to throw away. So how can you improve performance? You want to distribute work to many locations in the network where you decide on the fly which data is useful, but at the same time you don't want these locations to know, I mean they're helping you, but they don't know what it is that they're doing. So major problem is not clear how to maintain security, which is the focus of this talk. So here's what I want to do. I want to distribute filter and storage in the network. So this sits on the open network. Say on every computer, and it gets a stream of documents, let's say stream of email messages, so packets. And this sits on an untrusted computer, so it's a little filter with a little storage, and you run this code, which somehow magically throws most of it away and puts something into storage, and this could be given to the bad guys. And so even if they capture everything, they don't know what is being collected, and only some of these documents are collected. And then once an hour, once a day, these documents are sent to the classified environment, but just a small amount of documents that match the secret criteria, where you decrypt it, and you get back exactly the data that you were looking for. But even if everything is captured out on the open network, you don't know what the secret rules are. That's kind of a grand challenge.
Can you just go back in your animation?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So what's coming in is plain text.
What's coming in is plain text. Is encrypted. Right. So that's a grand challenge. We are just like in Dunstop. We are very far from doing it for arbitrary filters. I'll show you some limited filters where we can do it. But for general filters, I have no clue. And there's actually some impossibility results using algebra alone that William Skies is going to talk about on Friday. For this model. Okay, so and then the point here is that of course you don't want to store everything. This is just a small storage, so filter processes billions of data items, and then once an hour, once a day sends this small storage, encrypted storage, to the classified environment, and it kind of defeats the purpose if the storage stores everything it sees, then it just defeats the purpose, right? You want to collect only those documents that match the secret criteria, so that when the classified environment gets it, it just decrypts this little storage, and it doesn't have to look through the billions of data items. So it's in fact, this filter and the storage does a lot of work for the classified environment without understanding what it is that it's doing.
Rafi?
Yeah.
So is it important that you send just the documents that match the filter, for example, if you send twice as much?
Yeah, twice as much is fine, but I assume here that it's a streaming environment, so this stream is humongous compared to the number of documents. You have billions of documents and you want to catch only those that have the word president and a bomb and don't have the word toy, and you know, you can imagine complicated rules where only a tiny, tiny fraction of all the documents, you know, five documents match it out of the billions of documents, So what you want to send here, if let's say only a few documents match the secret criteria, is you want to keep tiny storage. If you're looking, let's say, for at most 5 documents, you know, at most 1 megabyte each. So this storage should be 5 megabytes, 10 megabytes, but this is a stream of billions of documents, and you want to send to the classified environment only, say, 20 megabytes a message. Yeah.
So there's an arbitrary bound on the number of things.
Yes, so excellent question. You see, yes. So you bound how much you are willing to collect.
So in terms of how protecting against these various adversaries in various locations, so the easiest one to protect against is the last one, the rightmost one. This one, right?
Right.
So just regular encryption would do.
Right, right. But the adversary gets to see everything, and he gets to choose the stream. Yeah, so good question. And so even if everything is captured, you should be out of luck figuring out what those secret rules are. Okay, so examples of filters. Look for all documents that contain special classified keywords, a bomb and a president, and or string or data item, and do not contain some other data selected by an analyst. And privacies must hide what rules are used to create the filter. Okay? And output must be encrypted. Yeah?
So, even if you print the filter as a black box, you can try to learn
it. No, because the output is encrypted. So, if you treat it as a black box, the black box chooses your data and outputs an encrypted state. And for every document that it eats, it modifies the encrypted state, and then the encryption is passed to the classified environment, so you don't see the input-output behavior. You just see that this little filter chews up a lot of data, you know, updating its little state, and then this little state goes to the classified environment, and only the classified environment decrypts it, so you have no clue what has been collected. But the point is, you want to hide which documents are stored in the filter and which documents are tossed away.
We also hide the number of documents.
Yeah, so that's a good question. That's coming. But the answer is you can put an upper bound on the number of documents, and I'll show you in a second that if it overflows, you can detect overflow. Overflow of good documents. You want to say that even if there's billions of mismatching documents, it doesn't affect the state of your filter. Okay, so more generally, we can define this notion of a public key program obfuscation. And again, what I'll show you is a very limited example of this, but I think it's a cool notion. Encrypted version of a program, so performs the same functionality as an obfuscated program, but produces encrypted output, and it's impossible in this formal sense to reverse engineer. A little more formally, you can say, can compile any code in
that way. Huh?
Okay, so you start with a program. So standard program obfuscations that I meet worked on and a bunch of other people is that you take a program and you translate it into a different program such that it has the same input-output behavior, but you cannot figure out how it works. And the impossibility results that were proven in this model. So this is a different model, and peer fits into it, of course. I mean, you should be saying, gee, this sounds like peer, but it's like, I mean, so you take a program, just a regular software program, and you turn it into another program with a decryption key. It performs the same functionality as the original program, but the output that it outputs is encrypted. So it produces encrypted output, and it should be impossible to reverse engineer. So it should behave like a black box, and you cannot learn input-output behavior because the output is encrypted. And you assume that only someone with a decryption key decrypts it and doesn't tell anything to the guy who's actually running this program. And it should be formally impossible to reverse engineer. So that's a different notion than the standard program obfuscation that I meet. And
so the only difference is that it produces an encrypted output?
Right.
That's
the only difference. But it's a key difference, because then you can do stuff that in the standard program obfuscation, I have no clue how to do. And in fact, there are very strong impossibility results in the standard program obfuscation, but surprisingly here I'll show you that some things are possible to do that are not possible with let me qualify it. It might still be possible to do it with a standard program obfuscation. No one knows how. But at least here I have some positive results. And in general, the general program obfuscation question is we know is impossible by results of Amit. well, Amit and like five other people who I'm blanking at the moment. So apologies for other courses in the audience. But here the I'll show you that this is actually possible for some programs. Okay, so public key program obfuscation can compile code into obfuscated code with small storage. Think of a compiler as a mapping, so it takes a source code and produces smart public key encryption with initial encrypted storage and the decryption key. And non-triviality is that sizes of a compiled program and encrypted storage and encrypted output are not much bigger compared to the uncompiled code, right? Because otherwise you can play standard cheat games. You say your encryption is just a standard semantically secure encryption, which is an identity, and then decryption actually does all the useful work. Okay. The question is, you're given some program.
Just the definition, what's the storage component?
You have a program, and you have its state.
Yes.
And as it runs, it updates its state.
Yes, so you're saying that the space that's used by this program, another restriction is that it's going to be small?
It has to be small.
Yes. Okay.
And because otherwise, it's trivial to satisfy. Why is it trivial to satisfy? Because you can say, I'm going to shove all...
Small
is not much bigger than the original size. So you can quantify it any way you like. I'll show you specific examples, but the point is, if you don't make this restriction, this is trivial to satisfy. You take any standard semantically secure encryption, and you just say, take the entire data stream or entire input, and just encrypt it, which is an identity function, but with the encrypted output, and then you say, well, the decryption key should actually perform all the work done by the function you want to do. And so that's trivial, but I'm saying if the output is small, compared to the input size, then you want something intelligent happen, and this is why I'm making this non-triviality requirement. Yeah.
But in terms of the storage, it seems that you can get rid of the storage by just requiring that you encrypt the output. That you're not allowed to just encrypt.
But the output you can encrypt, you can just do an identity function.
No,
think
but
of
that's not the output. If I want to map.
Right, right. You can insist that you encrypt only the output and nothing else.
Right.
But this is more restrictive than what I'm talking about here. Maybe you encrypt a little bit more, whatever it is, but you want non-triviality that you don't encrypt everything. So there is something useful that the smart public key encryption that is doing. Okay, nothing about the program is revealed given compiled code and storage. Yet someone who has a decryption key can recover the original output. So that's
So the decryption key, you also need to know the function?
The decryption key is supposed to know the function. You start with a function, and then you want to create the smart public key and the decryption key, and you can do it as a pair. And you want the non-triviality condition to hold. And for functions that output, small outputs at the input size, it's actually non-trivial. Yeah. No.
So the filter that
filter
learn as much as it wants.
Yeah. You can strengthen it, and there are ways in some cases to strengthen it that the filter outputs only what it's supposed to output and nothing else. But in this generality, you say, I just care about the size of the storage because I want to prevent this trivial solution of just encrypting the identity function.
It's completely equivalent to the requirement in peer. You have the trivial solution.
Exactly. Exactly.
And this, just like in peer, at least the basic definition of peer does not protect any other information.
Exactly. Exactly. Okay. So privacy that we want formally is that for any two functions in the class that you claim you can obfuscate, given right, the compiler output, which includes both the public key and the storage, must be computationally indistinguishable. That's exactly what you would expect. Related notions, as Moni mentioned, is private information retrieval. That's a restricted class of this functionality. Keyword peer, cryptographic counters, and program obfuscation. But there is an important. So those are the authors. Here output is identical to an obfuscated program, but in our case it is encrypted. So that's the major difference that I'm making. And so then the impossibility results about Program obfuscation do not apply because it's a different model. Okay, public key program obfuscation are more general notions than PIR with lots of applications. So what do we want? So now let me show you that this is actually possible. So you have this filter, and you have a bunch of documents coming in. Let's think of it as email messages, okay? So you have a bunch of email messages coming in, and you only want to store here in an encrypted form email messages that have the word bomb and the president. And everything else should go into the garbage can. So I guess you skipped 1.1, but you kept 1.2 and 1.3. And of course, even if it's captured by the adversary, he can say what's collected. And conundrum is that compiled filter code is not allowed to have any branch. I mean, this is not a necessary requirement, but I'm saying if you want to somehow formally prove that it doesn't reveal information, you better not have any branches. Because if you have branches, ifs and else, with a debugger, you can figure stuff out. So ifs and else executables that are related to this decision, what goes here and what goes here. And so two requirements, correctness
are
only.
Are you claiming that without this it's impossible?
No, I'm not claiming this. I'm saying, but the solutions that I will show you will satisfy this problem properties that it's a straight line code. So even though there's a condition, because it's a straight line code and the same will be executed all the time, you will not be able to figure out which documents go here and which documents go here. But maybe there are other approaches, I don't know. But at least this, you know, I know how to prove that it's good, because I'm going to say, look, it's a straight line code. You do the same thing for all the documents, so you can figure out the, I mean, I'll show you the actual trick in a second. So correctness, only matching documents are safe, nothing else. Efficiency, the decoding is proportional to the length of the buffer, not the size of the entire stream. Now, I want to, as a side remark, say that there was a subsequent work by Brand. So let me tell you what the comparison is. So in this paper, the buffer size, so M is the number of M is the number of documents you want to save, which is independent of the size of the stream. So we show how to save M log with a buffer of size M log M, and I'll show you how to do it. You can save M documents. And Brent, this is payback. Brent showed how to actually reduce this buffer size if you want to save M documents from M log M to M, which is very nice. Efficiency here that I insist on is that decoding time is proportional to the buffer size. So the point is you want to make work which is proportional just to the output, so you don't have to go again over the entire stream. And the kind of bad part about this work is that decoding time is proportional to the length of the entire stream. So when you get this buffer, it's much smaller. But to decode it, if the stream was a billion documents, you have to again go a billion times in order to decode it. But the memory is much smaller, which is very nice. Next, our construction. So I will show you how to do this. Okay. So let's just simplify things, and then I'll tell you actually that you can do slightly more general things. All keywords come from some polysized dictionary. That's not necessary, but let's just pretend. So it's English dictionary, and you want to say, I want to find all documents that have Arabic and Hebrew and Italian, right? It's, all keywords come from some polysized dictionary. And let's truncate all documents beyond certain lengths, 1 megabyte. OK, and you're looking for all documents that have the word president and bomb. So let me tell you how compiled code looks like. Suppose we are looking for all documents that contain some secret word from Webster Dictionary. This is even more specific.
I'm just confused. So you're looking at the equality function, or you're looking at the encryption with like a huge
So here's a game. You see a bunch of email messages. Every email message, say, is 1 megabyte long, containing English text. Okay. And you want to save only email messages, but exactly the email messages that contain the word bomb and the president and nothing else. Or let's say just one word. You want to collect all documents that have either the word bomb or the word president. You can do and here as well. I'll show you in a second. So you want to collect in your buffer only things that have these trigger words. You want to hide what the triggers are. And it's related to, well, yeah, okay. So here's how it looks to the adversary. For each document, execute the same code that looks as follows. So here's dictionary. And what you do is you put some encryption function across against every word in your dictionary, okay? And then there's some small output buffer, which I'll tell you. I mean, it's encrypted output buffer, so that's what the
Does putting an encryption function against a word mean you encrypt the word?
No.
What does it mean?
I'll show you in a second. Okay. I'm telling you, when you get your code, this is how it looks to you.
The same function, though.
This is, when I give you a code, I say, here's what you should do, and then I'll tell you kind of under the cover what's really going on. So this is, so the adversary gets to see a bunch of encryptions here, okay, and a bunch of encryptions in the output. And then what he has to do, and this is just to signify that they're all different encryptions, is you take the document which has, you know, some text, okay, you look up all the words that appear in this document. Okay, so it maybe this word appears, and this word appears, and this word appears. You take all this, so look up encryptions of all words appearing in the document and multiply them together. Take this value and apply some fixed formula to it to get value g. And I'll show you in a second why this works. I'm just saying this is a straight line code that the software has to execute. And then you take this value g and you just throw it in 20 random locations. That's it. That's what you do. All the documents, and what I'm going to show you in a second is that this actually, you can implement a conditional statement, even though this is what I described as a straight line code. Okay, yeah.
When you say throw it in 20 random locations, maybe you toss out what was there before or something?
No. So throw it, you say take the previous value and multiply, take this value, multiply with this value and store it back here. So multiply it into the buffer. And you do it for every document. And somehow we want to claim that all documents that don't match the secret criteria do not impact the buffer, right? So how should the solution look like? So here's our small buffer, and here comes a non-matching document. Okay, so somehow when you throw it in a buffer, it shouldn't impact the buffer, right? That's the intuition. And then when the matching document comes and you throw it in a buffer, you should actually preserve it somehow. Right, and so the next document, matching document comes, it's preserved and so on. Again, I went overboard with animation. But the point is, if there's a non-matching document which goes into the buffer, it should not change the value of the matching document in the buffer, okay? And so, okay, enough with animation. How do we accomplish this? So, okay, this is a general talk, so I don't have to remind anyone about public key encryption, right? Public key secret, well. So homomorphic public key encryptions for this talk will use Paillet properties. It's probabilistic, it's semantically secure, and homomorphic. So if you take an encryption of x and encryption of y, multiply it to get an encryption of x plus y. Okay? So using Paillet encryption, so let's look a little bit more carefully what Paillet gives us. So we have this property. So if you take, important to note is if you take encryption of a zero and raise it to some fixed constant c, well, that's like multiplying a bunch of zeros together, which is still a zero, right? Because on the other hand, if you take a one and you raise it to the c, it's like raise it to some fixed constant c, it's like multiplying one c times, which is exactly, you know, according to Paillet, is a summation of one c times, which is exactly c, right? So the point is, if somehow for matching documents we can produce an encryption of zero, and for the other way around. For matching documents we produce an encryption of one, and for non-matching documents we can produce an encryption of zero, then we are golden. So assume we can somehow compute an encrypted value V, which we don't know what V stands for, but it's an encryption of zero for uninteresting documents, in an encryption of one for interesting documents, okay? Then we are golden, because just using this trick, you can turn an uninteresting document into an encryption of a zero, an interesting document into an encryption of the document itself. So when you multiply encryption of a zero into a buffer, it's like adding a zero to the content of the buffer. It doesn't change the content of the buffer, it just re-encrypts it. Yeah?
But how do you know which buffer is the
buffers taken and what buffers not taken? You put two documents in
the buffer. Yeah, excellent question. Three slides addressing exactly this question.
C is your document here.
C is your document. So I'm saying, if you can somehow compute, if you can somehow do a song and a dance to compute a zero and a one, such that for matching documents it's always a one, and for my non-matching documents it's always a zero, then you are done. Because then you can just, instead of a zero and one, you get an encryption of a zero in one case, an encryption, precisely encryption of a document in another case, modular collisions, which is what been asked. So what is V to the C? It's either encryption of a zero, encryption of a document itself. So here's what we do. We take Paillet encryption, we put against all words that we care about an encryption of a one, and we put all the words that we don't care about an encryption of a zero, okay? And then initially you initialize the output buffer as a bunch of an encryption of a zero. So this is just to say it's semantically secure, so you don't know which is zero and which is a one. So when I take my document and I look up the words and multiply these things together, because we use Paillet, what happens? Well, what happens is this value is a zero if none of the words in this document are interesting, right? So it's exactly encryption of a zero if there are no matching words. And it's an encryption of a, well, C is a bad, because now I'm using C for something else. C is a number of matching words in this document, right? So if this D hit five interesting words, this will be an encryption of five, right? Okay. So now, if you take this value, and this is a straight line code, right? If you take this value and raise it to the D, what do you get? You get an encryption of a zero if there are no matching words, right, in this case. And you, if you take this value and raise it to the D, and there was some interesting words, then you get exactly C times D, where there are C matching words in this document, right? So now I don't exactly get an encryption of a document. What I can get is, if I can get an encryption of a document times C, which is a number of interesting words in the document, but I also know C itself, because C I computed here. So if I keep both values, encryption of a C and encryption of a C times D, then I can recover the document. You just keep both values, then when you get it as a pair, you just take this value, you divide it by C, and you get the document back. Yeah. D,
the whole document.
D, I say, let's say it's at most 1 megabyte. So you're doing.
RSA module?
No, RSA module is a Paillet encryption. You just do modular exponentiation. The document could be huge, but the security.
You have to do it by chunks.
Yeah, you have to do it by chunks, but they're modular. I mean, you can do it efficiently.
Except that, unlike usual encryption, you're using the public key process to encrypt the whole thing and not just the. Session key.
This is all public key, and I'm doing here, I'm taking the ciphertext and I'm manipulating it.
My whole point is just that, unlike regular encryption, where you to encrypt a document, you essentially encrypt the session key, and then using the session key, you use a more efficient crypto. Here you have to do it explicitly on all the.
So the point is here, I cannot encrypt the document D itself, but I encrypt a multiple of document by C, but I also know C, so if I encrypt this pair, I can recover D. Okay, so you just compute G, you compute G and G to the D, and you throw it into a bunch of buffers.
Couldn't you just select a session key and encrypt that and then do a submit?
Okay, you do G, you compute G and G to the D, which is a straight line code, and you throw it in a bunch of places, and that, okay, that's all well and good, but there was a question, what happens if there's a collision? So here's a bunch already of documents stored in a buffer, and now here comes another matching document, and oh my God, what happened? Well, it collided. This is terrible. So collisions cause two problems. So the problems is that good documents are destroyed and non-existent documents are fabricated. I mean, who knows, maybe this is some document that implicates an innocent person and it shouldn't be, right? I mean, the chances are small, but I mean, that's still, I don't want to take such chances. So how do we handle it? We'll make use of two combinatorial lemmas. So instead of telling you the combinatorial lemma, I'll show you a cartoon again. So here's a cartoon. I told you that you take this document and you replicate it a bunch of times, say 20 times. So why? Well, here comes the first document, green document, replicated a bunch of times, three times. And you throw it in a bunch of random locations. And then comes a blue document, and you throw it into a bunch of locations. And here the documents are destroyed. Well, I mean, using Brent's scheme, you can recover it, but then you run into a problem, into this other problem. So for my purposes, the documents are destroyed. So, but there is another copy of the green document and a blue document, so things are still fine. And the same happens here, right? So there is another pair of documents are destroyed, but there is still at least one copy of a blue document, green documents, and a yellow document sitting in a buffer by itself. And we say that this color game succeeds if for every document you throw into the buffer, they at least for each color, this color survives in at least one bucket. And so, and of course what happens is all the non-matching documents turn into encryptions of zero. So when you throw it into a buffer, they all go in, but they just re-encrypt your buffer, so they disappear. It doesn't affect the buffer at all. Okay, so claim is that color survival game succeeds with probability 1 minus negligible if you adjust the parameters correctly, if you make m log m and you throw m documents into buffers. Okay, how do we detect collision? Well, the idea is to append a highly structured yet random short combinatorial object to the message with the property that if two or more of them collide, the combinatorial property is destroyed. Right, so once you throw something into a buffer, you add some structure, and if there is a collision, then this type of a structure gets destroyed. So, and then we can always detect collisions if this happens with overwhelming probability, we will detect collisions with overwhelming probability. Yeah.
The tricky part is making sure that you don't find too many matching documents. Right.
So the question is, you pre-allocate, you say, I want to collect at most m documents, and then you allocate the buffer to be m log m for some fixed m. And then the question is, well, if there are more matching documents than you care about, can you detect an overflow? So I'll show you a trick how you detect an overflow, but let's say, and then you say, I goofed, I should have allocated a bigger buffer.
By the way, the probability of missing a document here is polynomial.
No, it's exponentially. If you adjust the parameters, if you make a buffer of size m log m, the probability of missing a good document becomes negligible.
Because it's negligible?
Yes. Less than 1 over poly for any poly.
Isn't the chance that another...
You play a trade-off here. I mean, I hate showing you this thing again. Point is, it drops exponentially with the number of colors.
Right.
So if you take, say...
And the basic is m or 2? The base is m or 2? The base of the exponent?
It depends on the size of the buffer. So if you make the buffer,
so the base of the exponent is the size of the buffer? It's the size of the buffer to the number of colors?
Suppose you want to collect m documents, okay?
Right.
You make the buffer, let's say, m log m,
yeah.
Okay? And you make this, say, log m, then the probability is negligible. So sorry that you have to suffer through this again. So how to detect collisions? That's what you do. And so here's a simple trick how you do it. Your signature is basically a random string. So remember, what are we trying to do here? We want to have some combinatorial structure. When written once, it's preserved, but if you overwrite two or more copies of it, it never reappears, right? So once you write the structure, it's fine, but if there are two or more collisions, it's always destroyed, this structure. So the structure, I mean, there are many ways to do it. One way to do it is you write a string, so those are just separators. So you write a string where for every triple of bits, you put a 1 in a random location and 0 elsewhere. Right, so here you put a 1, 0, 0, so the first position is a 1, and here you pick a third position of the one, and you do it completely at random. Okay. So you just take triples where every triple has a one in a random position among this triple. And the point is, if you take many such signatures and you multiply and you bitwise exclusive for them, then you get some structure where with an overwhelming probability in the number of such triples, some of them will not look right. Like it'll be a bunch of ones instead of just one per triple, and that's easy to prove. So that's what this says. Let H be a collection of k bit strings partitioned into k.
Your flight has landed here, or
what?
Your flight has landed, but you
not yet. But okay, so never mind. And the point is, you do the same for all the documents. I think Moni just killed one of my slides. So this is what you do. You multiply it together. And so this f of g is this structured thingy that you didn't want to listen about. So you take these triples, g to the d, and f of g, which is just a k-bit string, and multiply it to gamma. Gamma is a security parameter, make it 20. The probability of missing any document is 1 in a million, basically. And you multiply it into the triples that are initially initialized to zeros. The point here is that if it's a non-matching document, all three values will be encryptions of zero. So when you multiply it in, it doesn't change the previous value there. And if it's a matching document, then what I claimed happened will happen. And so that's what you do, and you're done. So how do you detect overflow? The idea is you double the buffer size from m to 2m. And what is the point? Well, you're trying to collect m documents. So you know if the number of documents is between m and 2m, it's an overflow. Because if you're trying to collect m documents, and it's a bigger buffer, so if you collect more than m documents between m and 2m, then you output the overflow. But you keep the buffer size the same. You don't double the buffer size. You double the buffer size, but then you count the number of documents. And then if the number of documents is greater than 2m, then there's a gap between m documents being caught and 2m documents being caught. So you can detect, so the number of collisions will have a big gap. So you can detect the big gap in the number of collisions, so you can just count the number of collisions and say with overwhelming probability there's more than 2m documents in the buffer, so again you detect overflow.
Who's doing the counting?
Huh?
Who's counting?
The decryption. Once you get the buffer, you decrypt it, and you see what happens. If there's less than m documents, for sure there's no overflow. And you say if there's more than m documents, either it's less than 2m, in which case I say it's an overflow. If it's more than 2m, and then I say, well, there's a gap between m documents and an overflow, which is so huge that there's a ton of collisions in the buffer, so I can distinguish the case less than m and greater than 2m.
Didn't you by then lose all the documents that you were supposed to collect?
What?
Yes. By then you already lost all the information.
Yes. You just detect overflow. You say, I preallocated space to save 1,000 documents, and somehow there was a huge overflow of interesting documents, so everything is lost. I would laugh.
The setup of the name insists on this, because you can't have the person who's building the buffer behave any differently.
Yeah, but you collect these documents because you want the different summaries of the
event. Yeah. So look, it would be ideal to have a different system where somehow the software stops collecting documents once you reach M. I would love you or anyone else in the audience to solve it. I have no idea how to do it. Okay, so I only know how to detect overflow. I don't know how to say enough, stop collecting it. I would love to see that solved. I have no idea how to do it.
Why don't you just do it, check every day, presumably in a case that are not enough documents?
Yeah, so system answers you can come up with. Those are systems answers, and you can come up with. Okay. More from the papers that we don't have time to discuss. You can actually reduce program size below the dictionary size using file hiding assumption. So instead of having this software, right, the software consists of this little applet and this big lookup table with word against the decryption, you can actually do slightly better using CMS, and Other sanctions, I don't know how to do, but you can reduce this table to a much smaller thing if the number of interesting words is small, because the information theoretically is only, you say you're looking for 5 words, so why should you have basically a unary encryption of the words you're interested in? So you can do something clever here, but using file hygiene assumption, I don't know how to do it. You can do queries containing a single end using BGN machinery, which the first two talks discussed extensively, so I'm not gonna. So you can eliminate negligible error probability using perfect hashing, but in practice that blows up the buffer size so much that you don't want to use it in practice. But you can eliminate. So this is what does it mean? That means that if the number of matching documents is strictly less than m, you want to collect all of them with probability 1, not 1 minus negligible. If there's more than m documents, you detect an overflow and you just give up.
What are the parameters for getting rid of layers? For the
it's polynomial. It's some huge polynomial that comes from...
Polynomial in m.
Polynomial in m,
yeah,
yes.
You have to go over all the perfect hash functions.
Yes. Scheme based on arbitrary homomorphic encryption, but again, it's less efficient, and there's a different trick because I cannot use Paillet, so you can use Galvassi-Micali. You can use whatever homomorphic encryption you like, but it's less efficient. I think the most efficient implementation that we figured out is Paillet. Extending towards not from the dictionary with small error probability, you can use tricks like, so there are some tricks you can do, but you allow small error probability. And conclusions is that we introduce private searching on streaming data, more generally public key program obfuscation, which is more general than peer or cryptographic counters. The efficient practical protocols, at least in calculating Paillet implementation of it, you can have your cake and eat it too. You can ensure that only useful documents are collected, and many possible extensions and lots of open problems, and that's it.